everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on a serious issue and invite individuals who have deep experience on the subject matter to share their opinions and insights. Our discussion today, the demise of American media and why mainstream news outlets simply don't matter. Dr. Marie Armadunian, fellow at the University of Southern California Center for International Studies and the host of the Scholar Circle and The Insiders, heard on KPFK, our sister station in Los Angeles, where I've also been for 30 years, and other stations, as well as the Progressive Radio Network. She is the author of Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, which details the power and influence of the media to shape the human condition. Also, for 5 years, Maria was served as the Environmental Commissioner for the City of Los Angeles, working on civil rights issues, environmental protection, and corporate reform. Her writings have appeared in the New York Times and Alternate and the Progressive publication. Her website is armoudian.com. Our next guest will be Robert Perry. Robert Perry is one of our leading progressive investigative journalists, best known for his uncovering Iran-Contra story and Oliver North's involvement, which earned him the George Polk Award for National Reporting. He currently writes for Consortium News and has covered many important stories on domestic and foreign affairs issues, including the Nicaraguan Contra cocaine connection, right-wing terrorism, the demise of the American media, and the Bush and Obama presidencies and the rise and influence of the neocons in our wars overseas. He has worked as a journalist for the Associated Press, Newsweek, and PBS Frontline. He's written several books, his latest being America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington to Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. The website is consortiumnews.com. Our final panelist is Professor Robert McChesney. Professor McChesney is an endowed professor of communications at the University of Illinois in Urbana. He specializes in political economy and communications, the history of 20th century media and communication policy. He is the co-founder of Free Press, a national media reform organization, as well as the host of the weekly radio program Media Matters. He's written extensively on the death of American journalism. He received many rewards from progressive forums. Putney Reader listed him among the 50 visionaries changing the world. Right-wing pundits have listed him as among America's most dangerous academics. Well, I think that's an honor that he received that. He has authored 15 books on communications and the media, and two released this year are Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, and How the Money Media Election Complex is Destroying America. The website is Robert McChesney, McChesney.com. Nice to have you all on today.
Thanks for having us.
Good.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you. I'm going to give a little overview here, as we do on this program. And Marie, we're going to start with you, if you don't mind. I think this is a wonderful panel because each of you has focused on different areas of the media while also understanding the breadth and depth of the problems of American media and journalism in general. And you all have given attention to corporate and government influence upon the Internet. Robert Perry, you're one of the nation's most seasoned journalists and reporters in print media and now the Internet. And Maria, you've been a national radio show talk host, a journalist as well. And I've now been a radio host for over 40 years, and I certainly have witnessed the demise of authentic reporting in the mainstream, as well as the marginalization of free speech, independent radio, and print media. So I'd like to begin with each of you, but we'll start with you, Marie, in turn, speaking about how compromised mainstream media has become And when we speak of media today, we have to include not only television and print and radio, but also now the Internet, because it has become such an important factor of shaping people's opinions on government, society, and the world and current events. And let's begin with your insights and also how you counsel students on this issue. Maria, the forum is yours.
I think Robert McChesney is absolutely the authority on talking about the influence of the need to make a lot of profit on the content of mass media. But what he has found and what many people have found is that this desperate need for eyeballs so that you can sell advertising has really been reaching to people's lowest urges. So mass media focus on things that generate strong emotions, fear, drama, extreme events. One of the examples in the most recent days when we saw what happened in the Boston Marathon is that all of the media, including independent media, by the way, and good alternative media, turned and focused on this event for about 2 weeks. But what happens when that it's kind of a competition for eyeballs, a competition for audiences. And again, not just corporate media, even the nonprofit media, even the media that tend to be oriented towards public affairs, while focusing on this event, tend to omit so many other vital issues. Many of the other debates just went by the wayside. And while there were, this was a very important thing to cover, and I'm not going to take away from that, there were, I believe, three people that were killed and how many injured, I think about 150. When you look at this in contrast to the gun deaths in the United States, it really pales in the tens of thousands of people who die by the gun. But that has not been focused on. Why is that? Part of it is the definition of news itself. News is the unusual. And the unusual is what attracts people. It is the drama. It is the conflict. It's the highly emotional. And these things are not always sexy issues. The other things that are missing consistently in mass media are historical context and bigger political context so that people can actually understand why we are in the positions that we are and how we got to the place that we are so that we can think about solutions. There's very little that we engage in terms of solutions. And then the final thing is that with all this focus on conflict and the problems between many people, it's hard to focus on what we have in common. And I would say there's a lot that Americans have in common, but there's been so much polarization, partly because we focus on those very issues where there is division or those very matters that there is division. And why is that? Because it makes for exciting media content so that more eyeballs come in and you can show more advertising. And not just advertising, get ratings.
I appreciate those insights. Professor McChesney, would you also follow up on that, please?
Well, those are very good points that Maria made. And it's an honor to be on the show, and Bob Perry is going to speak next, one of the really great journalists in America, so it's a privilege to be on the program with him. I'd simply add this, that the commercial pressures on journalism have largely been negative, and we see it throughout the 20th century, but especially in the last generation or so, in the reluctance of commercial news media to ever go outside the boundaries that are set by those at the head of the two political parties, the elites, to debate issues, political issues. And foreign policy, this has been nothing short of disastrous, because basically the range of debate is very narrow, and the opinions of the majority of the American people are oftentimes just discounted as irrelevant if they fall outside what elites want to do, like start a war in some country. But I think there's a bigger issue here, too, Gary, which is that the whole model of commercial journalism, and even commercial media, but journalism specifically, is disintegrating. And it's one of the great stories of the past 25 years. It really began, I think, as a result of the huge mergers of news media starting in the 70s and definitely in the 80s, where large companies basically realized they could make more money by sloughing off on doing journalism. So they basically, as a per capita amount of spending on journalism declined as a result of that. Starting 25 years ago, and it began to fall sharply in the 1990s. Foreign correspondents, all sorts of positions were terminated, were laid off. And we then saw the rise of the Internet and the World Wide Web, and especially in the last decade with smart media, Google search, social media. And what we have now is simply that it has accelerated and made permanent the sort of crisis for journalism, which is that the corporate community, the commercial community, the profit-seeking community of investors has determined, and I think probably accurately, that they can't make sufficient money doing what we would consider credible journalism to justify an investment. So the resources going now for working journalists, for newsrooms, is way below what it was on a per capita basis 25 years ago. It's even way below what it was 5 years ago. And this is not going to improve. The market has no solution for this problem, even online. It's really one of the great stories of our time that's not getting sufficient attention. And the reason for this is that journalism should be understood as, first and foremost, a public good. It's something that we desperately need, but that the market, so the pursuit of profit, can never provide a popular journalism in sufficient quality or quantity. For the last 125 years, that public good nature of journalism was hidden by the fact that advertising provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues. And because of that, it looked like journalism could be very profitable because of all the ad dollars. But once you stripped away the ad dollars, as we're doing now, you realize it isn't very profitable, and you start to shrivel up. And what's going on in the Internet right now is a revolution in advertising that I don't think people fully grasp, but I think people in the corporate media community are starting to get it, especially if they're in the journalism wing, which is that the traditional idea that advertising would bankroll media content, bankroll journalism, that you know, an advertiser would buy an ad on a website or in a magazine or on a TV news program, and then some of the proceeds from the payment for the advertisement would go to pay for the programming, that's dying and may well be almost dead, because when a corporation, a business wants to advertise online now, it doesn't buy an ad on a website anymore. It buys it through a network, and it's I want this demographic group. I want women 18 to 24 who are in the market to buy a new car in the next 3 months, who live in this part of the country, and I want 20 million hits or 20 million exposures, and I want them in the next 4 hours. And they will find those women, and they will hit them whatever website they go to. It doesn't matter if it's a media website or it's a Best Buy or a commercial website, wherever it is, they'll find them. And they will only advertise to those women online. And it means that the content producers at the websites that these women go to get a much smaller percentage of the take than they used to. Instead of 100% of the take, in the olden days, they're getting 5, 10% at most. And there's just no money in it whatsoever to subsidize journalism. And this is the great social problem, I think, of our era with regard to media and communication. How are we going to actually have the resources to have independent, competing newsrooms and journalists who actually can make a living doing it, that are accountable for what they do? And the market has no solution. Our public policy debates are bankrupt. And it's one of the reasons I'm on this show, is to try to encourage us to have that discussion.
Thank you for those insights. Robert Perry, your thoughts, please.
Well, some of these problems are intrinsic to journalism, and some have been around for really decades, centuries perhaps, and others are more current. It's always been true, I think, at least in my lifetime, that news is something that sort of grabs people's attention, that something that people are want to read. And as much as it's nice to think that it would be good to sort of give people good government accounts and tell them how best to operate in a democracy, there's always this reality that people want to be somewhat entertained by journalism. And I think there are ways to sort of cross that divide and make it work. At least there used to be. Some of the stories we did back when I was with the Associated Press about the Iran-Contra affair and Contra drug trafficking, things like that, were actually intrinsically very interesting. They involved abuse of government power at the highest levels. They involved the government getting in bed with some very unsavory characters. They involved issues of life and death, especially in places like Central America, where tens of thousands of people were killed. The odd thing was, though, as we moved into this current era, I'd say in the 80s and into the 90s and so forth, you started seeing almost a desire among news executives not to do those stories, not because they weren't intrinsically interesting. They are stories that would get people's attention. There was a political component that came in, an ideological component that develops in American journalism. It's sort of as a reaction to Watergate, as a reaction to the Pentagon Papers. There was a thinking at the levels of journalism that I encountered at places like Newsweek particularly, and at the Associated Press as well, where the news executives didn't want those stories because they caused problems for what they thought, what they would say is what's good for the country. There was actually a conscious sort of feeling that journalism should not be out there churning up this kind of dissent, this kind of concern, upsetting the American people, because there was a sense that all that happened during the 70s, or the uprisings around the Vietnam War, the rebellions on the campuses, obviously even before that, the civil rights movement, but coming forward that this was causing the United States to be weaker. And so there was actually an imposition of boredom, in a way, imposed on journalism for ideological reasons. Now, that was a phenomenon we saw really coming through the 80s and into the 90s, but it was also something where there was also the growth of ideological journalism almost exclusively from the right. There were some progressive news organizations, but there was really this effort by the right to understand the power of information and to really the power of propaganda and to organize itself through media to reach out to the American people in a way that, frankly, the progressives really weren't doing. And the mainstream fell into line over a number of years as the pounding of right-wing journalism and these right-wing attack groups, sort of anti-journalism attack groups, really took a toll on those of us who were trying to resist these trends. So by the time you get to the end of the 80s, into the 90s, many of the good journalists had been sort of shoved aside, even purged from the whole process. So you ended up with a much more kind of a frivolous journalism, focusing on things that actually would be considered relatively safe. Political scandals are the most sort of superficial sort, Monica Lewinsky kind of business. And these were not really getting to any heart of the problem. And in fact, the heart of the problem of the United States, what was happening with this whole idea of an imperial nation as it was, a government as it was evolving, was consciously ignored, even though I think Americans would have been very interested in that, and many Americans really were interested in that. But it was shoved aside, and it wasn't really shoved aside for even objective reasons of what really grabs eyeballs. It was shoved aside for reasons that were more ideological than that. And then you get in, as you move forward, there is both a disillusionment, I think, among many Americans about what journalism was producing. Not the sort of exciting, interesting stuff of the 70s where you had Watergate and the Pentagon Papers and you felt that journalism was really producing something worth reading. So then many Americans just sort of get tuned off to it. And then as we see the technological changes on top of that, particularly the decline of advertising in many ways for the newspapers, you began to see the emergence later of the Internet as an alternative for advertising, at least especially in terms of cutting out the classified ads through things like Craigslist, that then also these other factors then come in. And it is true, there really is no business model that works. And that is a serious problem. It's a problem for both in the mainstream, where people might actually want to invest some more money in journalism, but it's also a problem on the Internet in some of these places like I run, consortiumnews.com, where we never have the resources to do the work that needs to be done. We have to sort of find ways to still do it without the money. So you end up with a true dilemma. And it's a dilemma that has been brought about by a variety of factors, but that leads us to a point where the media is not really functioning in any way that would respect the concepts of a republic, a democratic republic. You end up with a media that is either ideological, where the information is simply given to you to sort of get you to go in a certain political direction, and that's almost entirely from the right these days, or it's frivolous. It deals with personalities, the most superficial sorts, and there's very little money being devoted to the production of real journalism as we used to know it. There are still some efforts. It's not entirely bleak. Some of the news organizations have become total shadows of what they used to be. Places like the Washington Post, which does very little good journalism these days and is very much almost a neoconservative outlet. But you still have with the New York Times some effort to do decent journalism. And I think probably the New York Times has shown that you can charge more for journalism. They've done more with their internet site to sell subscriptions that way. And they still produce some quality journalism, although granted it has been mixed in with some really inferior journalism. And during the last decade ago, when the New York Times and pretty much everybody else was on board with Bush's decision to invade Iraq, there was very little of the kind of counter-information, I would say accurate information, that might have given the nation pause. And we still see that, especially on, as I think Maria said, especially on issues like foreign policy. We have very little diversity in terms of how people look at things. Even a more liberal outlet like MSNBC, which, by the way, MSNBC initially tried to position itself to the right of Fox News, and only after that failed, because Fox had really gotten that right-wing area of the market, did MSNBC begin to experiment with more liberal broadcasting and giving itself more of the ratings that way. But if you go to MSNBC and listen to much of their commentary about foreign policy, it doesn't differ all that much in most cases. They'll have the same pundits on from the Brookings Institution or from these other sort of semi-neocon operations pushing the idea of more U.S. intervention, okay, and explaining why it's necessary. You don't really get, in those settings, the kind of challenging points of view that you might like. So it is true. We are faced with a crisis in media. And the biggest problem, I guess, is that there really is no business model that would sustain good journalism in a profitable way.
Okay, Robert.
That's why some have to deal with it through a nonprofit setup. But even that, you end up requiring some wealthy people to give you more donations. It's very hard to raise the money from average readers.
Robert, I'm going to do a follow up with you, and if you could give me just a little brief for answers on this, because I have other questions for the other panelists. Let me give you part of my concern, and then you respond. I did a film based upon the Gulf veterans' experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we saw so many things in the film that the American media, all the embedded journalists, all refused to cover, even though they were all aware of it. I sent a copy of this film to Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, Ed Schultz, every single person, over 6,000 copies of the American media, 6,000 members of the American media, all 50 state legislative bodies, all members, over 5,000 people, every member of Congress, all received it, plus over 100 of the activist celebrities in Hollywood. Not one single person responded. And here's what we showed. We showed the impact of depleted uranium. And we showed babies, thousands of babies in Iraq that are born with birth defects, without brains in their head, with cyclops eyes, things that you could not imagine. And yet the doctors in these hospitals kept saying, please show the American public. They have to see what the effect of these depleted uranium munitions are doing upon our environment and the people. They didn't do a thing. Then we have 18 million American children who go to bed hungry each day. They simply do not have enough food. We have 1.5 million American children in school who are homeless. They do not have a home to go to. They go out in the street when they leave school each day. We have 46 million Americans who are in dire poverty, but 100 million Americans who are just at, above, or below the official poverty line. We have a realistic figure of 22% of Americans who are unemployed. And yet the government and the media, both left and right, corporate media, both corporate Democrats, corporate Republicans, continues to base it upon 7% or so instead of the actual amount of people, including those who simply stop looking or those who may only work a few hours a week. We also do not look at the disparity between the amount of money made by corporate interest and how the American mainstream is exploited to make that profit. Offshoring of jobs, taking away benefits, insourcing highly skilled labor from India, South Korea, and other countries that take the job of a person that's worked for 20 years under a legal visa program. Nothing on this is in the American media. We won't have any of the American journalists on any of the networks condemning the actual food, if you can call it that, that children are advertised to buy that end up with an epidemic of childhood diabetes, but they're suffering from adult diabetes, obesity. We've never been fatter. We're the fattest nation in the world per population in the world. We spend the most on health care, yet we have one of the worst health care outcomes of 39 countries in the world. $3 trillion this year will be spent on health care. Almost $800 million of it is on administrative fees, and yet no one asks, why is this necessary? Instead, the arguments are defined by those in the media, both left and right, instead of by what needs to be addressed. We don't talk about the environment in a meaningful way. We don't talk about disease in a meaningful way. We don't have a preventative health care program, but we have plenty of room in the media to sell us drugs. Many of those drugs have never been fully tested for safety and efficacy. And then we end up having people like Danny Schechter, a multi-Emmy award-winning producer who did a documentary on the lies the administration made to get us into Iraq, and another one on the control room. We've had a couple good ones, Glenn Greenwald did, that clearly show that the media was manufactured through the vice president's office so that they could create the intelligence they needed to justify the war. And yet the mainstream media have never held them accountable by challenging them in interviews. Not once has this happened. So when we look at all this, and then we look at the fact that a Chris Hedges is considered an enemy of the state, or Glenn Greenwald is persona non grata, except on a few outlets. In fact, the finest voices of true progressivism and idealism are denied any virtue at all. And yet the talking heads from the Council on Foreign Relations, the Cato Institute, the Free Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, they're always the same ones we see. And never once do any of these people or generals or colonels say, I make this amount of money as a private contractor, and I'm here really to promote a military-industrial private contract ideology, but I'm going to let you believe that we need to spend $1.3 trillion this year, and yet we have 18 million hungry children. We can't help the children, but we will have another gigantic military enterprise that we don't need as redundant. The American media, in my opinion, has failed completely to address the authentic needs of America. It is an embarrassment, including the New York Times, with a few exceptional articles. They're never ahead of these stories. In fact, today, the New York Times, more often than not, comes in after the bully is down and then kicks it in the groin. We'll go up to the media and hit it in the face while it's still able to fight back. I never see these cowards doing that. Those are my thoughts, Robert. I'd like to hear yours.
Well, you know, Gary, I don't disagree with you. That's why I started Consortium News 18 years ago, and I, you know, did it at because I couldn't figure out a way to do the kind of important journalism that I was trying to do in the mainstream. I tried various different ways, and it's still that case. There are stories that we uncover, both historical stories and more current events, that even it doesn't matter, almost matter how much documentation you have now. I did a piece about going back to the history of how Richard Nixon obstructed the peace talks in 1968, basically getting into the actual files that that President Johnson had on Nixon's, what he called Nixon's treason. And there was really no interest, even when you can lay it out in great detail now with the actual documents and tape recordings of President Johnson and his conversations with other leaders. There's this, the mainstream press doesn't want to deal with that kind of topic. So it's not, it goes almost across the board. And I think that's why I fully agree with any kind of harsh criticism one wants to mete out to the mainstream press, which I was part of. And I saw it happening. There are cases, though, where some good journalists still get some good information out. There was a story on Sunday in the New York Times about the real nature of the Syrian rebel forces, how they really are largely controlled by the by extreme Islamist factions, not by the democratic elements that many Americans are led to believe. So there are still times when you'll see worthy stories appearing in the mainstream press, but I would agree with you that overall, the mainstream media in the United States has failed miserably.
Well, I just wish that there would be more honest people within the media. There are a handful. Let's go back over to you, Maria. What are your feelings? Go ahead, please.
No, I was thinking that one of the aspects of this that keeps coming up is, you know, what is the solution and are there alternative models? And one of the things that I looked at in my book, Kill the Messenger, was, you know, looked at all the weaknesses in each model. So, for example, you know, there's the BBC, which is a government-funded entity. It's a public entity, and it provides a public good. And you know what? Most of the time, the BBC is quite good. But I also studied the Northern Ireland crisis, and I can tell you, they were awful on Northern Ireland. They were very pro-British state, except for a handful of journalists that defied the British government when they had a broadcasting ban on airing the voices of particular people who were in persona non grata. And by the way, this was a law. This was not an unstated thing about, you know, a little whisper here and there, we shouldn't include this. So that's one model, which is government-funded model, and it's got benefits and it's got problems. Then I looked at, of course, the corporate model. We know, all of us know on this panel here, all of the major problems with that. And there's very little it delivers that is useful political public affairs information. But there are other models emerging, not that they don't have flaws in them. So a couple of models I looked at in other countries, Mexico, France, they had a co-op model where journalists came together and formed a nonprofit co-op where they owned it together. They didn't need to make a ton of money to reward shareholders. They were able to sustain their operation and make sure everybody got what they needed to get paid, and then they could drive the mission-oriented publication. So this worked pretty well, particularly in Mexico. That was one of the studies I did. But then you've got these other emerging models, some of the more investigative nonprofits like The Voice of Orange County or ProPublica, and they do contribute something, though it may not be necessarily, you know, everything that we need. But what we're seeing is kind of these pieces coming together slowly and experiments with models. But the co-op model was tried here in the U.S., but it failed for other reasons, not because of the model itself. Nonprofit, the open source model, I mean, Wikipedia's got its problems again. But what, you know, could there be something from there that is minus the flaws? And can the government contribute in a way without getting its hands in it, say by tax breaks, for example? Anyway, these are the things I thought we should perhaps really move to, so we can think about what might we try as journalists that would work. And I think Robert Perry's organization is starting to do some amazing things. I think Robert McChesney is doing amazing things. And, you know, it's as persona non grata as some of the other folks you've mentioned are, they're doing very well with their books and their journalism in their market. It's just that we've got such polarization going on between the media now, so that people who watch and listen to conservative media don't go to liberal media, and people who go to liberal media don't go to conservative media, and never the two shall meet. You'll even notice on Facebook, liberal people might unfriend their conservative friends, and conservative friends might unfriend their liberal friends because of this inability to talk anymore. So I'm thinking big tent these days. I'm trying to think about what model might have been more inclusive in this way. I'm leaning towards the cooperative model, but I don't know that it's the godsend. It's just one more thing to try.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Maria. Professor McChesney, I have about three different interlocking issues, if you would address them, please. I'm concerned that the Koch brothers could, if they chose, because they certainly have with over $119 billion a year in income, they could afford to buy the Tribune, and which would include the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune and many other papers. In effect, they could buy the media, and like Rupert Murdoch have, that gives them an enormous influence over much of what then is shared with us as news or commentary. That is an important issue. Separately, but also important, we broadcast repeatedly about the invasion of Iraq and why it wasn't a good idea and the likely outcome, and we have been shown to be correct. We also had information about Curveball, the so-called Iraqi expert that was blowing the whistle. We showed that intelligence agents already had given a lie detector test, found out he was lying. We could find this out, then why couldn't the New York Times or Judith Miller, who promoted this? Now, we were told that Libya had to be attacked, and NATO then got the support, a unilateral support first, and then a cooperative support for the bombing. And yet, what we predicted the likely outcome to be happened. Now we're told the same thing, that we have to go in there and get these weapons of mass destruction out of Syria. And they haven't shown us the proof that that what they're doing is anything more than meddling in a civil conflict. Yet clearly there's another agenda that the government's own news operatives are ahead of this curve, and the media is just following them. So when you see what we've done in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Syria now, and likely in Iran, what does that tell you about the power of individual forces within the media who are respected and who could say no? I'm not talking about the Seymour Hirsches. I'm not talking about the Jeremy Scahills of the Nation. I'm talking about those who are heavyweights that say, look, I've looked at the facts. They simply don't come down on your side. So we're going along with what they say. And lastly, I'd like for you to address the mental polarization in the media when it comes to accepting a conventional political line. For example, accepting fully, without question, the 9/11 Commission report, and then marginalizing anyone, no matter what their academic background, no matter what evidence they present, that challenges any part of that official line as being conspiratorial or best ignored. And this has been true for media for a long time. There were the lies to take us into Iraq, the scope of the Iran-Contra scandal, the Warren Commission, many lies. At the same time, although the media does not hesitate to dismiss contrary views and evidence as conspiratorial, it almost never acknowledges what is real as a conspiracy, even after the fact, like the Bay of Tonkin fiasco as just an example. Could you address these, please?
Well, I'll try to. You put a lot on the plate there for me, and I'll do the best I can, Gary. Let me start with the last issue. I'll work backwards. And that is that the coverage of 9/11 was really a low point for American journalism for all the reasons your second question talked about and that Bob Perry and Maria have spoken about. Which is that, you know, there's such an elite domination of issues like that among journalists. And one of the reasons why conspiracy theories flourish regarding 9/11, that it was an inside job, there's all this sort of stuff, was that the conventional journalism was so deplorable, left so much unanswered, it became open season for anyone to come up with their own theories, since the conventional journalism had left so much untouched. And it's a real sign that if you don't have good journalism, if you don't have credible journalism, if you don't have competing newsrooms, independent newsrooms trying to cover stories and push each other, you're just opening the floodgates to just paranoia and all sorts of superstition and silliness and conspiracy. That's what you get. That's the logical outcome of a journalism-free environment, because people are going to try to make sense of the world and try to understand it. Going to your first question about the Koch brothers, this is a great concern. With the collapse of journalism and the prices are just plummeting of these media properties, because there's no profitable reason a smart investor would ever buy one of them. I mean, they're so deplorable now. Most investors probably think twice, wouldn't even take them for free, because they're going to operate at a loss. So the prices have plummeted. The Philadelphia Inquirer, for example, I think sold last year for 10% of what it sold for in 2006. You know, it dropped off in value that much. And the Koch brothers, if they purchase these newspapers, will be doing it for political reasons. Their economic interests are very powerful, but they would use they buy the media and take them as maybe even a loss leader or not make much of a profit at all, because they know it would advance their political agenda. And, you know, for the Koch brothers, for Sheldon Adelson, as long as they can make sure there are there's no labor movement and their taxes are low and there's no regulations they have to worry, everything else is fine in the world. But those are the most important things to them. Those are crucial. And I think those media would be used to advance those issues that are near and dear to their heart. And it would give them an ability to even more decisively distort what the framing of stories of the news than already exists, which is, you know, alarming, as I think Bob Perry and Marie have talked about already, as you've talked about, Gary, in your long question to Bob. So it's a very bad thing. It's a sign of an absurd journalism system. And let me just continue the discussion that Robert has had already and that Marie has had and that I started. You know, how do we support journalism? Because it really gets down to that, ultimately. And I think the evidence is in. It's clear. It's crystal clear. There is no market solution. There never will be. And as long as we keep trying to play that drum, we're never going to have a satisfactory answer. The only way you can have a credible free press is through public support, extensive public support, just like an education system. Key, though, to democracy is to make sure the public support isn't hinged to political control, just like a key to an effective education system. University system is that the governor doesn't get to write the curriculum or hire the faculty based on what research they like. And it's not an impossible job to do, but it takes skill, commitment, and people of integrity to pull it off. I think it's a solvable problem. But that's where the discussion's got to be. If we're serious about having independent, competing newsrooms with people who can make a living doing their job, that's the way we go. And in my book, Digital Disconnect, I embellish an idea that was that John Nichols and I had worked on in The Death of Life of American Journalism, and that was embraced or introduced initially by the great economist Dean Baker, who you're probably familiar with. He's done such great work on Social Security and on the housing bubble over the last few years. And what Dean recommended, and I've embellished this idea, that every American should be allowed to allocate $200 of government money to any nonprofit and non-commercial medium of their choice. And so it would be a public subsidy, but the government would have no control over who got the money, as long as the group was had passed the IRS test to be a nonprofit and didn't accept advertising. And and the only condition to be put on is that whoever accepted this money, anything they produce would go instantly into the public domain and be distributed for free. It would not be protected by copyright. So the public wouldn't be subsidizing creation of copywritten protected material. So it would be a massive subsidy of journalism without a public subsidy for real resources, so that people would have income, but it would also be controlled by individuals. It would be highly competitive, non-commercial competition. So take Consortium News, Bob Perry's operation. If Bob could convince 10,000 people to give him their $200 government voucher, well, 10,000 people times 200 is what, 2 million? I'm just doing off the top of my head. $2 million. I wonder what Bob could do with $2 million. He could probably hire a bunch of great, talented reporters, produce the best content imaginable, and then the next year go out and get even more people to give him support. And if he slips up and does a lousy job, the people who have been supporting will find someone else to give their money to. But that's the sort of subsidy we have to be thinking of, something along those lines. There might be better ones than that, but we've got to put the best minds in our society. Stop thinking about how we can squeeze micro-advertising, suck up to some billionaire to bankroll the news like that's going to solve the problem, and get concrete and serious about how democracies operate.
Nice answer. Just a follow-up for you. You've written a great deal about the money-media relationship and influencing elections. Could you explain the relationship in greater depth, particularly with the media relations with the parties, and then speak about the refusal of the media to give any proper coverage of third parties? It doesn't necessarily have to be third-party candidates, but at least the issues raised by third parties against the duopoly of Washington's consensus.
Well, you know, this is the book that I've just finished that's being published in June. I co-author it with my dear friend John Nichols, and it's called Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And it's going to be published by Nation Books. And it's actually being printed, I think, this week as we speak. The book's all done. And we look at, you know, this vast flux of money into the election system. It's been going on for the 3 decades now, but it's exploded in the last few years after Citizens United. And we look at the role of the media, too. I mean, I think the media is much a part of this media election complex, money media election complex, as is Sheldon Adelson or the Koch brothers or General Electric or the big, you know, big firms. If we had a great journalism, you know, the ability of politicians, of wealthy people to buy ads and these secret groups to buy ads to distort elections would be really undermined a great deal. The problem we have to a certain extent is just that there is such terrible coverage, and it's absolutely collapsed in the last few decades. So there's barely any coverage of most elections now in this country that take place. And the election coverage we do get, as I think listeners are well aware, with a handful of exceptions, tends to be the worst journalism out there. It's like bad sports journalism. It's this horse race stuff that has no nutritional value. And one of the characteristics of our news coverage for a long time is that third parties are treated like pariahs. They simply almost get no attention whatsoever unless, and the big unless is, unless they're backed by billionaires or they're run by a billionaire. Donald Trump, we actually did the look at this, got more press coverage in his sort of putative consideration of running for president in 2011 for the Republican nomination. He got more press coverage. Donald Trump was a buffoon than Ralph Nader did in his legitimate race as the Green candidate in 2000. It wasn't even close in the amount of sort of mainstream news media coverage between the two races. It's third parties, especially if they're outside the range of legitimate debate, which they are generally going to be as a rule, otherwise they would stay within the two parties. Third parties get horrible coverage. It's one of the great weak spots of our political journalism. In fact, I would argue, and I think, Gary, you would agree based on the way you asked the question, that if journalism was going to provide a counterbalance to the effects of huge money on our elections and all these moronic negative ads that sort of, you know, marinate our brains for months now before elections, journalism would actually give more attention to the candidates who do the least amount of advertising, the candidates who are least known, to give them a shot at having access to the public. And, of course, they do just the opposite. The media almost entirely reinforce the power of money to dictate the terms of our elections nowadays.
Good point. Marie, one last question for you. Because you are so intimately aware of the role of the environment on people's lives, as you had that held a position that was crucial to this in the city of Los Angeles, why don't we see really good journalism where the journalist goes out and spends time with someone who has property where gas hydrofracking is either on the property directly or coming from a neighbor's property, and see what it's like? Or go into the homes of people who are having to decide, do they buy medicine or food or pay rent or their utilities because they can't do it all, and spend a month visiting those people to see what's it like. Or visit a kid that who is homeless, and how do they survive in a day? We're not getting the kind of journalism, in my opinion, from the mainstream that shows how most of the 270 million Americans who are not living a prosperous life are living. It's as if these people are invisible. Why can't we make them visible and show the truth of their existence?
Well, again, part of it is, of course, embedded in the corporate structure, the financial structure. That's only part of it, though. What's happened as the finances have dwindled is that newsrooms and journalism budgets have been slashed dramatically at nearly every institution, every newspaper, the television channels, and people are scrambling to cover a beat. Now, the beats are another driving force. You know, journalists tend to be assigned to a particular kind of beat to cover an institution usually, or, and usually that's a public official. It's not necessarily, you know, the neighbor who qualifies as one of these people, or these scientific issues that are kind of hard to untangle. So it's part of the structure of the journalism, but it's also the structure of the kind of what is going to bring in the advertising dollars. It's also that, you know, in the strive to get eyeballs, a lot of these publications, especially the broadcast, try to stick with things that are very simple and not get too complex. As soon as you start getting complex, they fear they're going to lose viewers. I was told even by an NPR station, don't give out numbers. Numbers confuse people. I said, what? You don't give out numbers? This is really important for people to know. They said, nope, just say most, you know, or least, or something like that. So there's this strive to sort of dumb things down, even among public stations. But, I, you know, most of it is who is going to go cover it when one person is assigned to the courts, one person is assigned to the police, one person is assigned to a congressional beat, you know, it starts to dwindle down more and more. Now, speaking of the environment, one of the things that I also have looked at pretty closely is how the climate debate has been severely hampered, partly by the kind of the focus on scandal that Robert Perry was talking about earlier. You know, for up until through about 2007, the media started to cover climate in a very realistic fashion, following Al Gore around, for example, when he put out his film that won a whole bunch of awards. But as soon as some conservative activists leaped on that email that dealt with an alleged integrity violation, you probably remember this, ClimateGate is what they called it. This was in 2009. All of the media debate around issues about climate became about whether these scientists were scam artists. And this was the word that kept being used over and over and over again, particularly in outlets like Fox News. What do you think happened to people's opinion about science? They immediately started to lose faith in scientists, and they no longer believed any of the realities that were coming out of science in the actual climate literature. So it's really irresponsible reporting. I think some of it is laziness. I think some of it is just there's not enough journalists to go around with the small amount of income that they that these institutions are getting. I mean, Robert Perry can't cover everything. He can cover what he can cover until there's more funding for him to bring on partners who can then cover each of these other beats.
Really appreciate, Maria, what you've been sharing, and all of our panelists. My guests, Maria Armudian, fellow at the University of Southern California Center for International Studies. Book is Kill the Messenger, and the website is armudian.com, A-R-M-O-U-D-I-A-N. Also, Robert Perry. Website is consortiumnews.com. The book, several books there, but America Stolen Narrative is his latest book. And also Professor Robert McChesney, and he is the endowed professor of communications at University of Illinois in Urbana, and author of many books, 15 books, including Digital Disconnect. And the website is robertmcchesney.com. To all of you, thank you very much for sharing what I consider very important insights into the issue of the media and what it represents and does not. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. You can download this program by going to TuneIn.com, PRN-FM, iTunes, Stitcher, many places. Thank you for listening and have a good day.